Amos Fortune, Free Man, Chapter 8, Amos on the Mountain. Ever since he had established himself in Jaffrey, Amos Fortune had longed to own a piece of land that he could call his. For some time now, he had eyed with delight a plot in the east section of town owned by William Turner, 25 acres of which Turner was willing to part with for a reasonable sum. During the past year, Amos had ridden over more than once to survey the land, the lay of the land, the brook large enough to allow him to excavate basins for training operations, the cleared fields where he could cultivate enough for his frugal needs, and the woodland from which he could get his tan bark and cordwood for the winter. So pleased was he at his last visit that he felt ready to offer William Turner the sum of money that would make the place his. But after the evening with Lois Perdue, Amos had begun to think differently. He told Violet how he felt, and as they sat outside the cabin after their noonday meal, and Celindia played nearby, "It makes a hurt in my heart to see Lois so badly, sadly off since Moses died. And all those little children with hardly a roof over their heads, or so much as a crust to eat," he said, his eyes on the mountain, but his hand resting on Violet's hands that were folded in her lap. "What are you fixing in your mind to do for that no-account family?" Violet asked wearily, her idea of the Perdues being far from his. "Buy a little house in the village for them," he said slowly. "Lois can do a piece of work now and then, and the children too. We'll get them some new clothes and help them start in life." "How come you can do such a high and mighty thing? There's pounds, shillings, and pence in the iron kettle. There's enough to help the Perdues, enough for us to buy a farm. Enough for both?" He shook his head. "No, not at the same time, but I've got a good trade, and I've still got my strength. We'll soon have money again to buy that our land." "Amos, Amos," she began imploringly. Then she stopped. Once it was his hard-earned money that had been used to buy her freedom. Now could she speak against his doing something with what was his for another in need? Violet closed her eyes to keep back the tears that had gathered in them, and she felt the pressure of his hand removed from hers as he got up and went inside the cabin. With her heart straining like a wild thing in a snare and the words she could not utter choking within her, she listened to him as he poked in the ashes of the hearth for the kettle that had been his bank. She had to hold on to herself to keep from flying to him and telling him what she had done. She was afraid now that she had done wrong. And yet last night, when it had come so clearly to her what to do, she had neither doubted nor been afraid. She would hold to what she had felt then, she told herself, and to what she had done this morning when she buried the kettle in the woods. She would hold as long as her courage held. Amos was standing in the doorway. She knew it, though her eyes were still closed. "Celindia," the voice so kind had an edge to it, and the little girl looked up quickly from her play. "Yes, Papa Amos?" "You've been playing with the ashes with Amos' big kettle?" Before she could answer, Violet spoke. "No, Amos. Celindia never goes near that kettle." Amos stood before Violet. "Then you know about my kettle?" Violet hung her head. It was no good trying to pretend. "Yes," she mumbled. Amos sat down beside her. He said nothing for a moment. Then he called to the little girls. "Celindia, you run up to Parson Ainsworth and tell him I've a piece of leather that would be fine for a Bible binding. I'll save it for him if he has a mind." "Yes, Papa Amos." Celindia dropped her toys and fleet-footed it from the cabin. She always liked to run errands, especially those that took her to the doors of the big folks' houses. "Why do you send the child away?" Violet asked. Amos' voice was low and tense. We may have things to say that won't sound pretty in a child's ears. Come, Violet, tell me what you have done with my iron kettle." She opened her eyes and she kept them on the mountain while she told him, speaking her words straight and true. "Amos, I've buried that kettle in the woods, and I'll go to my grave knowing where it is before I'll see you giving what's in it to a no-account woman who like as not will be no better off a year from hence." "Violet," he said, and his voice was hard and stern, "you dared to touch my money? You had no right. You gave me my freedom, Amos, and I'm bound to use it once before I die. But what made you do such a thing? You're a good woman, Violet, and what you've done is stealing. Violet cringed. The memory of beatings in her former days as a slave swept over her. But something was grieving her strength, and she felt she could stand a beating even at Amos's hands if she could be sure that what she had done was right. How many times, Amos Fortune, have you been standing on the way to laying hold of your own good life, and how many times have you set it all aside? 3 times. There was Lily, then there was Lydia, and then you put all on me, put your all on me. I'm not wanting Lois Perdue to live in hardship, but I'm thinking you've got a right to live in dignity. But Violet, he began. While the words were strong within her, she knew she must speak up. With all the help the town gave her, she never made herself any better, Violet insisted. The children are getting older. They're the ones to help her and help themselves too. You'll do more for them all by giving work to the boys than by giving money to Lois. But Violet, she would not listen to him until she had her say. There's a fire that burns fast and more fuel goes on it, and that's selflessness, Violet said stoutly. Lois is a shiftless woman, and money is just as much fuel to her fire. But Violet, he reasoned with her, we've got good trade. The money comes in all the time, and in another few years we'll be able to buy some land. A man has just so many years to live, and he should have something that his heart is set on before he dies. The Lord's been mighty good to you, Amos, and I think he wants you to be good to yourself. Maybe that's why he let you buy me. They talked until Celindia got back from the Ainsworths. But Amos could not, by intimidation, persuasion, or reasoning, get Violet to reveal the whereabouts of the iron kettle. All that afternoon he hunted for it, but he could find it nowhere. And Violet would say nothing except that she would bring it back to him when he was ready to go to William Turner with it. Amos tried to drown his feelings the next day when he stamped the ooze of the pit. He tried to drive them out as he beat on his hides, but it was no use. He could not free his mind of the thought of Lois Perdue, hungry and without hope, with their little children clamoring for all she could not give them. He wanted to help her in the only way he thought she could be helped. He wanted to do it his way, and he could not see that Violet's notion of letting the children earn some money could be of any present benefit. He found it hard to talk to Violet when he came in for his noonday meal, and Celindia, sitting across from them at table, looked from one to the other, wondering what had come between them. For Amos's face was tense and unsmiling, and Violet's eyes had tears in them. Violet felt that she would soon weaken and return the kettle to Amos for the ache that was in her at his displeasure. And yet, why was she his wife, she asked herself, but to help him to a good life? One more day, she prayed. Let me hold out one more day, Lord, and then you tell me if I've done a wrong thing and should undo it. And Amos prayed, standing in the ooze, give me a sign, Lord. Give me a sign and help me to see it is coming from you. Then I'll know what to do. I'll know it for sure as my name is Amos. That night, Amos went up to the mountain, feeling he could no longer abide the sadness in Violet's face and the questioning in Celindia's. The walls of the cabin seemed to close in upon him, so that he felt he must soon push them aside with the strength of his arms or be stifled. He took a portion of the loaf of bread and a bottle of water, for he knew that he would not come back until he had his sign. Violet watched him go, and she thought to herself, if by tomorrow he still feels as he does, I'll know I'm the one that's done wrong, and I'll come and I'll give him back his own and ask forgiveness with it. Amos climbed as long as the daylight lasted, across the rocky pastures at the base of the mountain, up the path winding steeply through the belt of woodland. By the time light had gone with the sun and came only from the moon, he had reached the wilderness of rocks and rugged trees that was Monadnock's summit. Once there, he looked down at the land below him, bathed in a milky haze of moonlight. He was breathing heavily, and it took him a long time to gain not only his breath, but his composure. Looking from the height made him look back over his life. He saw with a sudden start of realization that just as he had come a far way up the mountain to gain its crest, so had he traveled a far way through the years to gain the point at which he stood. He still had his strength, or a good portion of it, and he had his trade. but that was all. His freedom was assured as well as that was of his wife and child. Yet he owned no land, nothing they could call theirs if the chariot came for him soon. He thought about his family and what would happen to them when he was no longer there to care for them. Then turning his gaze towards Squantum, he thought of Lois's needing help so badly. Ever since he had had his freedom, he had saved one small fortune and then another. Now he wanted to spend once more the hard-earned savings in the iron kettle, and Violet would not let him. What right had she to oppose him? Yet it was he who had given her freedom. The word was meaningless unless it, in its light, each one lived up to his highest and his best. "Oh, Lord," said Amos, "you've always got an answer, and you're always ready to give it to the man who trusts you. Keep me open-hearted this night, so when it comes, I'll know it's you speaking, and I'll heed what you have to say." He found a small cavern in the rocks on the downward slope, where he made a shelter for the night, and the shelter was welcome, for though it had been warm in the valley, the wind blew cold on the summit. He thought it would be a night of vigil, but sleep overcame him, and the world grew silent around him. What time the great sound came, he never knew, but it was sometime between midnight and dawn, when a tired man sleeps his heaviest. When it came, he was suddenly as awake as if he had never known that what sleep was. Like the bellowing of bulls, it sounded as it came over the mountain, like the roaring of the sea, and then it was gone. So held had he been by the sound that he was not aware of the wind that swept over him. But in the faint breaking light of early dawn, he saw the bending of bushes near him, the wild azalea and the blueberry laden with blossom, and he knew that a great wind had passed by. Overwhelmed with reverence, he rose and fell to his knees. The mountain has spoken. He had heard it with his own ears. He had seen it with his own eyes. Nature bow before it. He remembered hearing Parson Ainsworth and a group of men talking about the Monadnock roar one day, and they had said that all mountains made such a sound at times. Mountains with forests growing up their slopes and summits that lay in the path of storms. The wind blowing along the mountain and meeting another current blowing down the mountain could cause a roar loud enough to deafen a man, save that its duration was brief. That was what he had heard them saying in the town. But to Amos on the mountain, what he had just heard was the voice of God, and because he had asked to hear it, he knew that he must heed it. He prayed then, but it was not his usual morning prayer. He prayed that he might understand aright what he had witnessed. Sitting on a boulder, he broke his bread and slowly drank his water and watched the light of day fill up the valley. Mist rose from lakes and low-lying places, putting out white streamers that the warmth of the sun gradually dispersed. From stalwart houses standing in wide fields and rugged cabins and small patches of cleared land, trickles of smoke began appearing as people got life into their fires. They had their morning meals, then went forth refreshed and strengthened into fields and woods to do the work of the day. Watching the increase of the day and the activities, Amos Fortune, a man who was landless save for the kindness of a parson, thought what a good thing it must be to own a few acres of land, to bring them to bear, to leave them better than when they came to one's hand. For land was the wealth of a new country. To have land was to have an iron kettle with money always in it. Then up there alone on the mountain, he smiled broadly to himself, for something was drawing in him like the light of morning dawning on the world. He looked up at the wide blue sky arching that much nearer him than when he looked up at it from the valley. "Thank you kindly, Lord," he said, putting his hand to his head in that small gesture of respect he had long ago learned from the white man. Then he bent over and touched his lips to the ground. But what made him do that, or why he did not know. Violet was working at her loom when he returned to the cabin. She did not hear him enter for the noise she was making with the treadles. She did not know he was there until he stood behind her and put his two hands on her shoulders. She ceased her work and sat silent, not knowing what to say. And yet there was something in the way his hands rested on her that spoke of peace between them. He said thoughtfully, "Violet, I've come to thinking that the best thing a man can do is to own his own piece of land for himself and for his family. I'm going to ride over to William Turner's this afternoon, but I'd rather not go empty-handed. She put her hands on her head, and a small joyous sound escaped her. Then she gestured towards the hearth. Amos turned and saw the iron kettle in its own place, half hidden by ashes. "Why have you brought it back?" he asked, surprised. Then she spoke her words, were the first easy one she had muttered in 3 days. "Whatever you had a mind to do when you came back from the mountain, I wasn't going to keep what was yours from you any longer." "It belongs to us both," Amos said, "and you were right to guard it." That afternoon, Amos and Violet rode over to William Turner's and signed the deed that put 25 acres of land cleared and forest with a brook running through it in Amos Fortune's name. And there, by the bank of the brook, Amos built his own house, strong enough to meet the stress of time and the force of storms. He built a barn and a tanyard and excavated basins in the brook for his work. And Violet planted the treasures that she had been tending all the time they lived in Parson Ainsworth's land. Her lilac and tea rose, her japonica and the lily of the valley pips. By the end of 1789, when Amos Fortune was in his 80th year, he became a landowner in his own right, and one of his life's long dreams was fulfilled.